Jesus loves him, but the rest of us think he's a putz. It's the Drew Marshall Show.
Well, you are listening to the Drew Marshall Show. We're streaming live at drewmarshall.ca. We're live right here in Southern Ontario on Joy 1250. Our next guest intimidated me to no end at the beginning of our relationship.
Is that because he's so smart?
SMRT.
Damn, so smart.
No, he's kind of a connected dude, you know?
How do you mean?
Well, he's a senior partner at the LA law firm of Hertz, Lichtenstein, and Young. Every time I hear the word Liechtenstein, I think of
the smallest country in Europe.
No, I can't remember the name of the movie with the Australian actor who died, young guy, and the
Heath
and the
Ledger.
Knights, Heath Ledger, and they were
Knight's
a Knight's Tale.
Tale.
Thank you very much. It's like
no wonder you felt intimidated.
Oh my goodness. Anyway, Ken and his partners specialize in representing talent and new media companies in the sports and entertainment industries. His clients include Will and Jada Smith, no doubt Gwen Stefani. Black Eyed Peas, Will I Am, Sir Ken Robinson. Do you remember the interview we had with Sir Ken Robinson?
Oh, well, he's like, I'm a teacher. He's a big, education guy. I love Kenneth.
Keith Richards, Herbie Hancock, Jason Mraz, Britney Spears, yada, yada, yada. It goes on and on and on. He is also a principal in Membrane, an entertainment marketing and strategy consulting firm. Membrane's clients include Hasbro, McDonald's, Intel, Miller Coors, Logitech, and the Drew Marshall Show. He's on the phone with us because he's also the host of the TEDx Hollywood. Ladies and gentlemen, Kenneth B. Hertz. Ken, the first question I have for you is, what does B stand for?
Benjamin.
Were you named after somebody named Benjamin, or was that just a name they pulled out of the Old Testament?
No, it was. That's funny that you asked that. It was my great-grandfather's name.
So the reason you're on the show today is because you and I had a conversation in September down at, Hotel W or something, I don't know, poolside courtyard thing. And I saw your soul crack open for the first time. I didn't think you had a soul before that day. And
everyone has a soul.
And then I just saw this visceral response to what you experienced during Passover. I think it was around that time. I don't know. I can't even remember what was going on. You guys, I mean, when I keep saying you guys, I mean your people. You have so many holidays. How do you get anything done?
Well, I'm not particularly observant, so they don't affect me that much. So, I only go to the ones that revolve around food.
Right. Well, that's most of them, I think. Except, hold on, you were fasting when we spoke that time. So listen, one of the very first times that I realized you actually gave a holy grunt about the Jewish side of your life is when I was staying at your house and you had the table set up for some festival. And I said, "What's this all set up for?" And you were explaining to me that you were hosting something. A Seder, maybe? Would that be it?
Yeah, that would be Passover.
So how seriously do you take your own faith? I mean, that's an awkward question to start this conversation with because, you know, it's kind of a standard joke, or not even a joke, but an observation. You know, the Jews run Hollywood, and you're one of those guys. But then you have, you know, private conversation with them, with different people, and you think, man, what, do you have any morals? Do you have any ethics? How can you call yourself a Jew? So I'm not quite sure where this conversation is going to go, but you have always reeked of generosity and grace and compassion, and I thought, well, no, maybe he does have a soul. So let's go back to what you grew up with, Ken. Talk about the faith of your youth. What did you grow up with?
Well, it's interesting. My father worked at NASA. He was Air Force, and he worked at NASA, and we lived in Houston, Texas, and we lived 20 miles from the nearest synagogue, and there was only one other Jewish family that lived anywhere near us or that worked at NASA at that time. And, for my parents who grew up in the Northeast, for both of them, I think being Jewish was more important to them, or at least raising, having a Jewish home was more important to them because of where we lived and because of, you know, the people that we knew and because of the environment that my sister and I grew up in, than it might have been had we lived in, you know, New York or Los Angeles or, you know, even Atlanta or any other big city that has a large Jewish population. Or if we had lived in, you know, even parts of Houston where there's a large Jewish population. I mean, I think most port towns on the east and even in the south have large Jewish populations because that's where the boats arrived.
So what do you think has been the greatest impact in you retaining some faith, you know, the faith of your ancestors? Would it be marriage? Would it be kids? Would it be the family you grew up in, your family of origin? What do you think has been the greatest factor in you maintaining the whole journey?
You know, it's interesting that you ask it like that because I'm going to disagree with the premise of the question. I'm really not a person of faith. I'm a person of education. I mean, I'm a person who believes that, in fact, on many levels, Christ had it right. In other words, I'm someone who thinks that we just need to be kinder to each other. What I've learned in my life is that, you know, the things that make me happy and make other people happy are acts of selflessness, right? And that if you do things that are truly selfless, then you get more out of it than you put into it. And I just wonder why we're not more people aren't that way. I think the gift that the Jews gave the world was this gift that you don't worship things and you don't worship idols, but you believe in a social compact, which is that we need to take care of each other and we need to care about each other and we need to be kind to each other.
Okay, so are you a Jew or not? And by the way, every time I say the word Jew, it sounds like I'm saying a bad word. Is that?
No, I don't think so. It's what they are. They're Jewish. They're Jew or Christian, follower of Christ.
Okay. Well, that's the Louis C.K. joke, right? The Jew is the only word that it both describes people and is also an insult. Right? In other words, it just depends on how you say it. You know, like he's a Jew or he's a Jew. So it's a tone of voice thing. But I think the answer to your question is yes, I'm absolutely a Jew, but I think Jew is the only religion in the world that's also an ethnicity.
Yeah.
Right? In other words, ask the French. The French Jews that were carted off by the Nazis consider themselves French, not Jewish in most cases, or in many cases at least. And I think that's the fact is the Nazis didn't care. If there was one drop of Jewish blood, you were Jewish. I mean, Sarkozy, has Jewish ancestors and supposedly discovered it while he was president. Madeleine Albright has Jewish ancestors and discovered it while she was in office. I think the truth is that for the rest of the world, being Jewish is an ethnic identity, a nationality, if you will, which is, I think, why, at least in the post-World War II era, why Israel was such an important thing, because the idea of giving Jews a homeland wasn't about segregating a religious group. It was about giving a nationality a place to live.
Okay, so if you're just, and this, hear how I'm saying this, because I know you will, so I'm going to point it out anyway. If you're just a cultural Jew, why do all the Jewy stuff? If it's not a faith for you, if it's not a spiritual thing for you, a religion.
Well, I think the ancients, I can answer that. I think the ancients, got a lot of it right. In other words, the whole idea, for example, the whole idea of Jewish New Year, for me at least, and the idea of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, this year the rabbi gave a great sermon where he talked about the fact that what separated Abraham from his father was that his father was a pagan, and Abraham believed that our lives were not dictated by the gods and by fate, but in fact that the choices that we make in our lives matter, and that we matter. And I think that is what the idea of Jewish New Year is to say, it's important to stop once a year and take a look at your life and take a look at the things you do and take a look at the way you behave and and recognize that the things that you do have an impact on other people, and the choices that you make have an impact on other people's lives, and that you have an obligation as a member of society to make things right with other people. You know, in Yom Kippur, the idea of atonement is, for Jews at least, is not that God, you know, lets you off the hook. The idea is that God always lets you off the hook. In other words, your pact with God, if you will, if you believe in God, your pact with God is that God is this unlimited power of giving, right? And he is forgiving no matter what you do. Hmm. But that the things that you do, the crimes that you commit against other people, against your friends, it's up to you to make those right. You have to go and apologize, and you have to go and say, I'm sorry, and really mean it. You know, I always laugh when people apologize with these non-apology apologies, right? When they say, well, if I upset you, I'm sorry. that's not an apology,
right?
And so it's hard to apologize. It's hard to acknowledge that you did something wrong and that you want to make it right and that you're willing to make a sacrifice to make it right. And that is an act of selflessness, and that is what will make you happy. And I do think that in that regard, the ancients got it right. Passover is about slavery, right? It's not just about enslavement of people. It's about being enslaved by your ego and being enslaved by your, you know, addictions and being enslaved by your, you know, material desires and all of those things. And we all are. You know, the people that can't give money to a charity without putting their name on the side of a building are enslaved by something.
You know, earlier in the conversation, Kid, I think you said, I'm too smart to be religious.
No, I didn't. But I'm flattered that you would say that.
No, there was something that you said that, you know, because I asked if, you know, but is this a religion for, or, you know, why do you maintain the religion? And you sort of said something like, you know, I'm sort of more into the, I don't know, what do you say, science or, you know.
Tradition.
No, I didn't. I just said, no, I didn't say that. I said, I am not a person of faith.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, why aren't you a person of faith?
I don't believe in the unknown.
Why?
Because I think that's silly.
This is where I'm going. Right.
But I didn't say I'm too smart to be, a person of faith. I'm just saying I think that, listen, you know, most modern religions were created at a time when we knew very little. We knew very little about the universe. Right. We knew very little about why things happened in our world. We knew very little about science.
Right.
Most scientific progress has been made in the last 200 years.
So right? what you're saying is back in the day when the lunar eclipse happened or when the solar eclipse happened, we said that was God or was Zeus or was, I don't know, whatever. And these days we go, it's an eclipse.
It wasn't hard to imagine. You know, listen, they still talk about evolution as though it's a theory. Right, there are still people who believe that. And I heard a great interview with Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson, you know, like Charles Darwin III, with Krista Tippett on, I think it was Krista Tippett on NPR on Speaking of Faith. And she interviewed him, and she said to him, it was like the anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth or the publication of The Origin of the Species, something like that. And she said to him, you know, your name is Charles Darwin. You know, when you pull out your credit card in a restaurant or a store and they see that your name is Charles Darwin, do they make a big fuss about you? And he had a great answer for her. And he said, you know, it's only in America that evolution is treated as a theory.
Right.
You know, they don't make a fuss about me anywhere because, you know, they don't even remember who originated the theory of evolution because it's no longer a theory. It is clear that the human species evolved from other species. The evidence is overwhelming. It is no longer treated as a theory by anyone other than people that believe religion is more important than science.
Okay, so
that is an old idea that no longer stands up to scrutiny.
So two quick responses here. One is we had Gandhi's grandson on our show a few weeks ago, and he has the same kind of experience pulling out his credit card or a passport, going through customs or whatever, you know. And his name is kind of, oh, you have quite a famous last name. He said, well, that's actually my grandfather. Oh, but then they don't even really know. Like the younger folks don't know. They don't know who Gandhi is, which is really amazing in some ways. Anyway, that had nothing to do with where I wanted to go. Where I wanted to go was, let's talk about faith people in your world, in Hollywood world, in the celebrity world. Some folks, like John Ratzenberger, who I've had on the show before, you know, he's part of this sort of secret Republican, it's not secret at all, club of celebrities. Gary Sinise heads it up. And one of the things, you know, the Republicans, and they whinge about the fact, not all of them, but some of them whinge about the fact that they don't get work because they're Christians. Do you buy that?
No.
So they don't get work because they're jerks. Do you buy that?
I imagine that there are some people that don't want to work with jerks. And you know, there's, listen, 99.9% of the members of SAG are unemployed at any given time. And as we all know from watching television or from going to movies, the same handful of actors seem to be getting all of the work at any given, you know, for over a 3 or 4 year period, the same actors seem to get cast in all the roles all the time.
Right.
So the idea that John Ratzenberger is not getting work because he is an observant Christian seems
I'm not saying that about John at all. I'm just saying he's part of that Republican thing, and then, you know, there's the whole Republicans in Hollywood, and then you multiply by tens when you talk about the Christians in Hollywood, and, you know, Kirk Cameron's never going to work again, whatever. My point is, some people think that you liberal Jews who control Hollywood sit around and have meetings and discuss, you know, who the wacky religious actors are that we don't want to hire.
Yes, well, I did attend the World Domination Conference in Tel Aviv 2 years in a row, and David Geffen gave a keynote address where he said exactly what you're saying.
Thank you. And
Jeffrey Katzenberg, I think, argued with him, at the time they gave a Life Achievement Award to Michael Eisner, who, by the way, is an atheist.
Yes.
You know, I'm making all of that up, by the way.
Oh, okay.
I think that for whatever reason, you know, there are lots of Jews in Hollywood. There are lots of Jews in the clothing industry. There are lots of Jews in the toy business. There are lots of Jews that have succeeded and survived and thrived, in fact, in many industries. Generally speaking, the reason for that is that until the middle of the last century, I don't think Jews were allowed in many places to own land. I think, you know, you didn't find a lot of Jewish farmers in America because Jews weren't allowed to own property, right? They weren't allowed to buy homes. They ended up living in cities where you could rent apartments because they weren't allowed to own things. And, you know, most people don't realize that in fact, the Jews that got off the boat from, you know, Eastern Europe, from Russia, you know, that came here with skills. You know, they came from places where they weren't allowed to own land, and they came here with skills, you know, in tailoring or in, you know, manufacturing, or they came here with a degree in engineering, or they were doctors, what have you, they were professionals, you know, or they were none of those things, and they realized that if they didn't quickly learn how to speak the language and they didn't push their children to, you know, overachieve, they were never going to have a chance to participate in the American dream. And so, that all of that said, do I think that Jews are uncomfortable around people who believe that they will rot in hell? I don't know. Would you be?
Ken Hertz on the phone. He's an entertainment attorney. He's a brilliant conversationalist, and he's just brilliant. That's me sucking up. Of all the celebs that you've hung out with, and I still remember going to some pool party you wanted to do. That was the first time you introduced me to Bryn. And it was at a TED conference, and it was on the roof of this building, and there was a pool, and Goldie Hawn was
in
there.
Long Beach.
Yeah, Long Beach, that's right. And there was all these celebs and stuff. It was still weird. Like, I will always feel like an outsider in your world. But the fascination with celebs gets really weird with people in the world of faith. Because as soon as somebody of a particular faith finds out that a celeb is their faith, that group likes to sink their hooks into them. But, you know, let's talk about Richard Gere, you know, being a Buddhist. And now there's, you know, he's involved with Uma Thurman's dad, Robert Thurman, who we had on the show a few weeks ago.
So, the professor?
Yeah. Very fascinating gentleman.
Yeah, brilliant guy.
So when you meet celebs, do they typically not talk about their faith in the celeb world as much? Do they hold their cards, their faith cards, close to their chest? What's been your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think most celebrities who are I think most celebrities try to keep their private life private because they are, you know, their business is in drawing a crowd, and you know, if your business is to be popular, then you know, sharing personal details that may or may not polarize people, I think, is something that you try not to do. I mean, I think the more savvy celebrities are, you know, try to maintain a certain line between, you know, their public life and their private life. It's becoming harder and harder to do so, but I think, you know, I think that's their gift, really, is that their knack for managing their public image in such a way as to offend or alienate the smallest number of people.
Sure. And would you say that's the same as far as corporations are concerned? They don't want representatives who are vocal about their belief systems? I mean, you've worked with a lot of giant corporations. Is the feeling in the corporate world, keep that stuff to yourself?
Well, no, I think the feeling in the corporate world is, you know, that politics and religion polarize people. And if you're trying to sell things,
right,
then you
so
want to
keep
an audience and as big a consumer base as possible. So you don't want to alienate people. So you stay out of politics and you stay out of religion. Because not because you don't have a point of view about it, or because, I mean, look, there's plenty of companies that lead with their faith because, I mean, and not necessarily for commercial reasons, but because they're run by people who feel strongly that that's part of their corporate social responsibility. But most publicly traded companies, I think, have made the choice not to engage in that discussion, regardless of what their executives think, regardless of what their shareholders think, regardless of what their customers think. You know, I mean, I think we live in a marketing-driven world. So, you know, if you're in the business of selling things, then you are going to make choices about discussions related to faith based upon, you know, your economic desires. And obviously that adulterates the conversation, and obviously that, you know, undermines the perceived sincerity with which you discuss these issues.
Ken, just as we're coming to the end of our time with Ken Hertz, ladies and gentlemen, who has impacted you spiritually the most? I'm not saying you bought in. I'm just saying somebody rocked your world from a spiritual point of view, from a faith-based point of view, somebody you respect, somebody who said something. Maybe it was at a TED conference, or maybe it was Temple or something. I don't know. Somebody who has rocked your world the most. A few people, maybe even.
So I am very friendly. It's funny that you said this. I don't have a lot of discussions around this subject, right? But, you know, I am very friendly with, and, you know, he's my age, which makes it, you know, part of the attraction. But Steve Leader, who is a rabbi in Los Angeles, is someone whose life experience is very similar to my own. You know, he grew up in a, you know, middle-class Jewish family in Minneapolis, in his case. I grew up in Houston and then in Los Angeles, and he and I have traveled together, and we have, you know, had many meals together, and we have seen each other, you know, socially as opposed to professionally. I mean, his profession or my profession. And so, you know, we have a friendship. And you know, he is a rabbi. He's chosen to devote his life to, you know, his religion. And so because we're friends, because I think he's very smart, and because, you know, I believe that he's sincere, you know, he and I have discussed matters of, you know, public policy and religion and politics and faith on many occasions, and in circumstances where, you know, we don't have cell phones on us, or we don't have coverage, or we're not distracted, and we can, you know, we can have a philosophical conversation without being interrupted. And you know, those conversations have in many ways educated my point of view, certainly in my you know, in my adult life.
Yeah.
And you know, it's made a tremendous impact on me. I think he's a brilliant man, and I think he has you know, a great sense of humor, which is, I think, you have to have if you're going to have an intelligent conversation about subjects like this.
Yeah, sure, you know? Sure. Well, I cannot believe that you and Will and Jada Smith, I mean, he's been your longest client. You've been with Will Smith for how many years now?
Actually, Herbie Hancock is my longest term client.
Oh, sorry.
He was my very first client. That's okay. Will and I have worked together now for 27 years.
Okay. And were you not part of the original pitch for Fresh Prince?
Yes, I actually went around knocking on doors and showing anyone that would let me the music video from Parents Just Don't Understand, and suggesting that this kid might have a TV series in him.
So these guys reek of spiritual stuff. At least that's my impression. You haven't had any deep philosophical conversations with those guys about religion and faith and spirituality? No?
With my clients?
Specifically with Will and Jada.
If I had, would I discuss it with
you? No, I don't want to know the content. I just want to say, I'm asking. No, stop it. I know you better than that. I maintain
a pretty solid wall in most cases between my clients and myself regarding our professional relationship and our personal relationship.
Yeah.
I can tell you I am very friendly with the Smith family. And we have shared many moments of, we've shared many joyous moments that involve our families as opposed to our work. And so, yes, I've had many conversations with them, which are not of a professional nature.
No. And I would imagine that, though, I mean, I'm sorry, but I would think that those conversations would be just as intellectual, just as filled with wonderings about things that are unprovable.
I have to say, there is not a greater student of theology that I have ever met personally than Will Smith.
There you go. That's what I'm saying.
He is fascinated. He's fascinated by the subject, and he is extremely knowledgeable on most modern religions, certainly all of the great religions, and far more knowledgeable than people would expect, and far more thoughtful about the subject.
Just before we say goodbye, the charity you are the closest with these days, tell me about this water. What's it called again? You're giving water?
Charity Water.
That's it.
Charity Water. And it's actually run by a guy named Scott Harrison, who I met shortly after his 30th birthday when he started the organization. He's raised hundreds of millions of dollars to solve the world's biggest problem, which is the lack of clean drinking water. Mm. And it's an extraordinary organization. Anyone who wants to know more about it should go to charitywater.org.
Charitywater.org.
And the money that you give, 100% of the money that you give, goes directly to dig wells or to create water treatment facilities and sanitation facilities in places where people don't have access to clean water. And it is an extraordinary thing. Give me 2 seconds to share this with you. It changes everything. It changes lives. It gets girls back in school. It puts women back into the economy, which is the best way to solve for poverty. And it eliminates, all sorts of diseases. 80% of the children that die in the world die from waterborne diseases. And, in many places, all you need to do is dig a well and maintain it. And that's what this organization does. And they are amazing. And he is amazing, and he's somebody you should have on your show. He is a person that is very much of faith, and it is his faith that drives his and motivates him to do what he does, and he does an extraordinary job.
Man, when I first met you, I wasn't sure whether I liked you, but man, I like you.
I like you too.
Ken Hertz, ladies and gentlemen, I really appreciate you being on my show. I can't believe it's taken me this long to figure it out, but it's... Yeah, you're just a refreshing individual. I appreciate it a lot, Ken.
Thank you. I'm so flattered you asked.
Have a great weekend, sir.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. Ken Hertz on The Drew Marshall Show. The plane landed, and when I came out, there was a dude looked like a cop standing there with my name out. I ain't trying to get arrested.